So what happens when we arrive in here with the bell? We may sit waiting to be told what happens next. We may do what we normally do, maybe begin meditating. What happens if you aren't told what to do next?
Yeah.
Like, where do we come from? How do we enter into this space? What is it that moves us or informs our choice, our orientation? Pretty much every time we act or respond, there's an opportunity for cultivating, for supporting, for developing the wholesome. Do we remember that? Do we notice that opportunity? And if we do, how do we respond to it? It's a basic orientation shift that transforms what could be called a worldly life into a spiritual life. And it's the shift from relating to the situations and experiences we find ourselves in as an opportunity to see what I can get, to seeing them as an opportunity to explore what I might learn, how I might grow. That sense of learning, of growing, that sense of potentiality for that. If we bring that with us into any experience, into any situation, then there's an opportunity there that we are allowing ourselves to receive. Whether what's occurring is enjoyable, entertaining, flattering, desirable, or quite the opposite. So, I'm kind of interested to ask, how was your lunch? Not just in terms of did you like or not like what happened, which you may or may not have done, but in terms of, was there something useful in that? Or if there was nothing useful in that for you, is there any way that might be useful? And I'm curious if any of you have a response in terms of what you noticed or whether you found something useful or not. And before you decide whether or not you want to say anything, just notice how that invitation is received by you with a sense of, no way, I'm not talking, or great, I was just hoping. And we've got the 15 chapter sort of description of what happened ready to go. Because really the important, although there's something lovely and valuable in being able to share and to be a little space for that, it's more useful to be asking ourselves that question of the situations we find ourselves in again and again and again. That's really the question. Was there something useful? Or if there wasn't, what use is that? What do I learn from that? The whole process and the parami of effort, of virya, so quite a warrior-like quality, is described by the Buddha as being the cultivation, the support and the sustaining of that which is wholesome. And the abandoning, the letting go and the non-supporting of that which is not wholesome, which is not contributing to well-being and happiness. And the way we do this is very simple. We look and see what's happening and ask that question. Is this useful? Oh, okay, if it's useful, wholesome, beneficial, let's support it and continue it. If it's not, okay, how can I not supported? What would be involved in not perpetuating this pattern of thinking or behaviour or action? And that's really the way in which we translate our understanding into life, is by exploring and seeing what works and what doesn't. With that question at the forefront of, what's useful here? Very pragmatic. It's not something too much about philosophies or grand ideas. But very pragmatic. So,
I thought it was useful, very useful. I think I felt great gratitude throughout. Mm. Beginning because it was going down, we were in a circle, and I liked the freedom of exchanging and taking what came, and the graciousness with which everybody did that. Well, my group did that. A twinge of humour, twinkle in people's eyes, which is delightful. But I liked all the freedom that he gave us to go, not to choose to have a nice lunch. And so there was a real sense of gratitude. There was no taking for granted that there was anything wrong with mine. So thank you.
Well, I'm happy to hear that and interested. Yeah, some nice pieces of touching there in terms of gratitude and actually the sense that it felt like you had some freedom within it. Because I realised when I thought about this and reflected on this on a train journey on the way here, what would I do? What might I do to evoke some of these qualities or practices? I actually had in mind to, at the point before I said do it, say, anyone who doesn't want to do this, you don't have to. And then I just didn't remember that in the moment. So I thought, well, it could make it look like actually you didn't have a choice about that. And yet I hope there was some sense of choice in it there still.
I'd like to see this opportunity to say to Lynn, give me a place. Because I couldn't hear you properly. I'm having a hearing test. And when I got it, I thought, God, I thought you were right. Because it's nothing to do with a choice, it's just that I wasn't feeling hungry. So really, really I'm saying thank you. I hope you remember where God is in this place right now.
Sure.
And I appreciate that.
I had a whole range of, sorry.
Continue.
I had a whole range of responses. At first, I was, before we started, I was very excited. I wonder how someone would do it. This is really interesting. You know, it's going to be an interesting exercise. I was really quite excited. Then, when I filled my plate up, I thought, I quite like this. What if I go back and there's not enough of this thing left? So there's a kind of, this thing. And then, and I noticed that when we stood in a group, my first response was to look at the next person's face. Because I wanted to see which one was I going to get. So there's kind of quite a few conflicting emotions. And then in the end I thought, well, that's fine. I'll just, whatever I get given will be absolutely fine. But there was a bit of impatience on my part. I thought, for goodness sake, what's the fuss about? You know, you've got to well eat what you're given, you know.
Okay, yeah.
So why all the ritual about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a generational thing, you know. Mm-hmm. I was brought up in a generation where you did eat what was given.
Yeah.
And allergies and foibles were considered to be, you know, nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a whole range of responses to
right.
coming out.
Right.
And it was very dynamic. It changed.
Great. And so again, really useful to see all the ways in which also something like this isn't easy or okay. It's not like this is just supposed to be a nice experience, we feel good. Lovely if that happens, but fine to be going, this is a stupid idea, I don't want any part of it, and that's what my parents used to tell me, so to hell with it, you know. That would be a valid response, if one's willing to look and see what's going on here. And it seems there's that space for you to do that. And yeah, a lot of us have, particularly around renunciation and just kind of having to put up with, we've learned to shut down our response and just not feel happy or sad about what's happening. Just, I've got to put up with it. I can't have this. I have to have that. And the way we take on teachings like renunciation and practice can easily reinforce a real rigidity around that sort of thing and the way in which it's sort of being done to us, which is why when I mentioned the thing about putting the choice in, that was my intent. I've not done this with a group before like this. And that was part of my intention, is that this would have to be something we would choose to feel. And that, I mean, hopefully there was some sense of that in that. But sometimes what's important is to emphasize the sense of, no, actually, I can just take what I like. And hopefully for some there will be the sense of, yeah, actually it's important for me to allow myself to have something and choose what I want. And they will have gone and taken that and done that. And others will have also seen, oh, something useful about just receiving what I'm given here. Because most of us in this generation, you know, that's not been done so much. And, you know, either way is useful. Either way has its benefit. One, there's the freedom to say, well, no, I'm going to go and have a piece of that chocolate cake because it looked good, you know. And others will say, well, actually, I'll just eat what's here. Something about that, that there's no blueprint for us all. Mm. Sorry, there was a lady here and then...
I just noticed just then is that I wasn't listening to you properly because I was thinking about what I was going to say. I mean, I knew what I was going to say before, and then the dealer. So it might be different now.
Sure. But great that you're noticing that. That's what's useful there, huh?
What I noticed was that though I didn't want to part with my plate of food, it was really, while I was standing there, the smell of it was really. Kind of made me really hungry, and I really wanted to eat my plate of food. When I sat down with the plate that I was given and ate it mindfully, which is, you know, part of what we're doing, I really, really enjoyed it. And I might have enjoyed it more than my plate of food because there were things that I wouldn't have chosen.
Right.
So they were kind of new and fresh. Then we came to when I finished. There was a bit of an issue, wasn't there? And
sure.
I was saying to my husband that it was something that came up all the way through. Well, you know, this is lovely. It's really satisfying when you don't eat anymore. And I thought, oh, bit of fruit. You allowed a bit of fruit. You know, I kind of rationalised why I was allowed a bit of fruit. But then I got in there and I had a bit of fruit in it. Anyway, so that was quite an interesting point. I think I might have eaten less than I normally would have, though. Because I always eat quite a lot here because it's such a food and there's such tempting variety. So, but it was very interesting.
Great, good. Sorry. Okay, I'll come back to you. Sure. It's
one is that today I'm in charge of the catering.
So a difficult situation in a couple of ways there for you. Yeah, yeah. There's the work, and it looks like there's going to be more work. And I didn't say to everyone at the beginning, though I hope the message that I gave was passed on later, that it was fine for the job just to take as long as it needed and us to start later. But I didn't say that at the beginning and put you at ease. And I could have, but I didn't. So in one sense, I would say sorry for creating extra anxiety there. And yeah, interesting. The anxiety was there, and yet in the end, was the experience of washing up at the end, was it in line with what was anticipated? I'm curious. For yourself?
For myself.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, that's really interesting to notice, isn't it? And totally understandable your response. Whoops, things are taken out of my control by someone who doesn't really care or know what's going on. Has this ever happened to anybody else? I mean, I recognise the experience for myself, so I'm guessing You know, some of us have seen it before. And that, and then likewise with the food. So yes, really hard to see that there might be food, good food, that someone else could enjoy, and it's being, it seems wasted. Yeah? So, again, I'm not saying that this was or should have been in any way different for you than it was. But I'm curious, is there anything that was useful for you in going through that process? And it's fine if there wasn't. Yeah. Mm. Great. And how does it feel to have A, said it, and B, recognized that that response that's coming right now and right here is something that's useful and wholesome and beneficial? Because it is. Yeah? How does that affect you, impact you right now, acknowledging that? Interesting. Well, I'm happy to hear that in terms of that. And I really appreciate your expressing what may not have been easy to express. You, in fact, said, I'm sorry to say this. And I'm actually really glad you said it. So I hope you hear that. Thank you. So, yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Someone's messing with my food.
You know, and I tried to do things that, you know, I like. And I thought it's really nice when you said the person was giving you food, you know, that's what. The moment before I got the plate, I was, you know, I don't want this other thing. But I thought, this isn't food I don't want. Mm-hmm. This is food someone else wants, and that's mm-hmm. really nice to get. Mm-hmm.
Right, renunciation isn't always deprivation. In fact, done skillfully, it's not that at all. Because even if the meal that we got wasn't quite what we might have taken for ourselves, the lesson or the learning we might have got could well be the more important event of the day in the end. That's not the one we focus on when we're thinking stomach. Yeah, good. Thank you. So maybe one more? There's someone there. That's interesting. Right. So they're seeing the real power of just doing something differently. Without ascribing a value of better or worse in terms of the food or the what's there, but it's just, oh, do it differently, and somehow it brings a natural freshness and engagement and interest, and is a skillful means for engaging with the activities. Just finding some way to make it a little different often makes a real difference to how much we can really receive from the experience. Good. So maybe, there will be some more time at the end if there's some other pieces someone wants to add, unless there's someone who's feeling very much burning to say something that hasn't been spoken to, and that they really would feel like they were being cut off if they didn't right now get to say. Yeah? Sure. Okay.
I just realised that someone I was speaking to, I paid a lot more attention to what I was speaking. Not only because I knew it was going to be someone else, but because you insisted on the fact that we had to pick things that would be really makes me realise that I often just fall into patterns of habit when it comes to eating, even if I try to eat well. I don't gift myself as much as I would others.
Interesting. Right. So, again, okay, useful. People hear that? Yeah, good. Sometimes it's giving others that we have to work on. Sometimes it's giving to ourselves. And yeah. Just to notice where we tend to lean. So, if you'd like to bring around a tray, so let's have a sitting just for a little while. Kind of warm, isn't it? I certainly notice sometimes in the heat there's a tendency towards a little drowsiness. Maybe the challenges of the day that lead to some sense of that. And I'd just like to speak some more about these parami. And the framework, the sense in which this whole teaching when collected in this way is given is very much within the sense of our journey as being one of exploring what it might mean to live our life, not just for our own well-being, but for the welfare of others. To see this cultivation of the wholesome and the beautiful as a way of bringing into this world more of what we would wish to see in this world, in a way to transform the world both through our own inner transformation but equally through the way in which our actions move into the world. So a lot of this territory, in many ways it's more about how we engage outwardly. To look and see how that can be explored, as it is about the inner process of cultivation that we might be more familiar with in terms of meditation. And it's part of why it's useful to sometimes explore and do those experiments or adventures or whatever we might call it in the real world, where we actually take ourselves out of our comfort zone and see, okay, what could I develop? What could I learn? How could I grow here? And the sense of seeking to awaken for all beings, that this journey of the spiritual potential, or the realizing of our spiritual potential, is something that involves all beings. It's really helpful to remember that in those times when we feel a bit hot and I wouldn't mind a nap, you know? It's not just about what we want. Not that we disregard what we want, as one or two of you were exploring, and very interestingly it seemed, with the food sort of practice that we did together. In the sense of, but there's something more here than just that. Something larger, something greater. So, I'd just like to speak some more about these qualities, the ones I haven't spoken of to any degree at this point, because there's something very inspiring about them, the sense that this is possible for us to grow, to develop in these ways. And just to hear them, even the list, as I did read out at the beginning, and just thinking of these qualities, just letting them in a way land as if they were like pebbles in a pond of our heart and our mind. Just what it is to encounter in this world or within ourselves these qualities. Generosity. Dana. Virtue, non-harming. Sila. Patience. Kanti. truthfulness, sakya, resolve, the word is adhitana in the Pali, effort or energy, sometimes we need that on a sunny afternoon, virya in the Pali, loving kindness, metta, many of you will be familiar with that term, friendliness, renunciation, nekamma, which we've been practicing with our food, and equanimity, upekka. These qualities, there's something just very beautiful. It may or may not strike you in this way as you hear them. Again, it may just sound like a list, but I just want to read them out. They've really been something that have been held as a beacon for humanity, that we can orient towards, that we can turn towards, that we can start to see in ourselves where they are already present and how they can be developed, how they can grow, how they can deepen. So some of what we've practiced already, just mentioning again, sense of giving, of sharing, so beautiful, so powerful, to share that which we would perhaps like to have all for ourselves, and yet something in that sharing and in the receiving and the gratitude that a number of you spoke about, that sense of gratitude is so powerful, and it really links us to each other. Part of what's powerful and what's spoken of in the tradition, the power of dana, is that it makes connections. And so we're invited and encouraged not just to give because of the benefit and the well-being of the one who receives what we've given, but because it connects us. When we make an offering, or equally when we receive one, but that's not something we can make happen, we can receive, but we can choose to give, and it makes a connection to something. When we give our energy or our resources, we connect with that which we've given to, and it becomes stronger in our life and in the world. So that movement of giving is something very powerful in that way. And the sense of non-harming, of virtue, what it offers us is a sense of being at peace with how we've lived our lives. To live in the condition of, as the Buddha said, the condition of no remorse. Which isn't to say we won't look back and recognize we've made mistakes and that we might feel some sorrow for that, or need on occasion to make amends for that. It's not like we're perfect at this. But there's a sense of, I've done as well as I can here, and that my intention was wholesome, to refrain from causing harm. There's an immense ease in the heart when we can have that as a foundation that we refer back to. That, yeah, that's true. I've done what I can. Not perfectly. Where I didn't get it perfect, I tried to make it up, and that I wouldn't have done perfectly either. And yet, there's something very, very freeing for the heart to just have that as a foundation. Letting go, renunciation, nikamma. Very interesting. How much aliveness it brings. And this is something that some of you mentioned, others of you I sensed and heard it in what you spoke about. The freshness, the newness. Letting go, by its definition, or letting go of what we think we need or want or should have. When we're in that and we're operating from that, it's like we're very much caught in routines and patterns, and we see the thing we usually eat and we take it and we eat it, but the seeing, the taking and the eating, we're not really fully there for, because we're just playing out an old pattern of identity, that this is who I am and what I eat and when I eat it and how much and like this. And somehow letting go, that stepping out of our comfort zone, that letting go requires of us to give away, and or just to, there's a letting go and just saying, I'll eat some of what I've been given. I don't have to eat it all, but just some of what's been put in front of me. And like, oh wow, I have a different relationship here. So there's something very fresh that happens for us, something very alive that happens for us when we let go. When we say, okay, I'll see what it's like here. I might never do it again if it turns out to have been a really bad idea. But let me see. Let me not assume that I know that already. And as someone said, in fact, I might have even enjoyed the food more. Interesting. there's often an unexpected gift in letting go, because it opens us up to receive. And all too often, if we're holding on, we don't really receive what we're holding on to. We don't let ourselves receive the food because we're too tight. Not as a judgment of ourselves, but just as an acknowledgement. Oh yeah, I want, I must have, I need this. No, don't want any of that. There's a tightness in that for us. And when it's like, well, I would have liked to have this, I didn't really want any of that, but this is what I've got. There's something more open about that. Qualitatively, we can start to sense how that's transformative. Quality of effort, of that kind of engaging. It takes an effort to step out of our habits and our patterns, to not just follow the old and the familiar. You know, there's that great, I don't know if it's a proverb or whatever, that says something like, only dead fish always swim with the tide. And yet, you know, kind of there's a certain death that happens when we just fall asleep in our habit, in our preference, in our comfort. And there's this real interesting balance we're asked to bring here, of bringing a sort of a relaxing but a not falling asleep quality in that, a relaxing, and actually a really engaged relaxation. It's a very interesting mixture. It's not what we're used to. And that effort quality is needed for that sense of virya, that sense of sort of making an effort, putting one's arms up or standing up. It's an expression of that, and sometimes it's what's needed. If we're drowsy, it's like there's not enough energy. We can't just manufacture energy, but we can do something which supports it. And what's really interesting, in lots of ways, the mind cannot necessarily change its own experience. It can't change its own condition as an act of will. But the mind can ask the body to do something. And then so the mind can affect the body, and then the body affects the mind. So without our intentionality, we don't sit upright. We'll just be here. Probably habitually something like this, if you're me. Sort of just flop. But the mind says, actually sit upright. And the body listens. Good. Yeah, I can do that. And then that quality of uprightness actually supports the mind. There's a relationship there. This is another expression of it, or standing up. Likewise, the mind's feeling stressed. The mind can't make itself relax. But we can notice, oh, stressed. And then tune into the quality of relaxation or ease in the body. There's some tension around here, but you know, this bit's quite soft. The mind changes. Or we're feeling scared or anxious. And we can't make ourselves not be anxious, but seeing that, we can just sense, well, what's the ground feel like under me? And that requires that we don't just go with the predominant feeling and assume that's an absolute, solid, substantial reality. It's more like, oh, that's how it is, but that's part of the experience. And the tendency is to get sucked into thinking that's the whole thing. A certain effort, a certain opening, stepping back. Oh, actually, maybe we can remember there's some ground under our feet. And that allows that sense of anxiety to have somewhere to rest. So that sense of engaging, not trying to control or manipulate, but just seeing, well, what happens if I make the posture a bit more firm like this when I'm drowsy? Well, what happens if I actually just let it soften a little bit when I'm feeling tense? And you notice, huh? Makes a difference. And at the same time, with effort and energy, there also has to be patience, can't there? Beautiful quality of just not being in a hurry and accepting how things are. It's like, patience. We can't be doing what we're doing in order to get a quick fix here. That's so much our cultural urge. You know, we want it all and we want it now. And yet this process, it seems, takes time. In some sense, there's a very immediate quality to what's possible here and now. We can just open. We can reconnect, yes. And we see that there are layers and levels in which we're still exploring what it means for me to be able to do that, to really open and connect and be present in a conscious way. There are degrees and dimensions of that are something we can explore for our lifetime and if there's beyond that, then certainly beyond that as well. And what easily happens to us in meditation practice is that we can sometimes think, well, you know, I've been doing this a while, I should have got somewhere with this. I should have got it together by now. A very similar thing happens to us around difficult mind states and emotions. I should be over that by now. I should have sorted out my fear or my confusion or my reactivity, my anger. You know, shouldn't I be finished with that all by now? You ever had that kind of thought? So there's a story that I heard involving an encounter between His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and a practitioner who'd been a follower of a school, the teachings of the Dalai Lama and his tradition for many years, but he'd not had a chance to meet with him before. And he had this very special opportunity to talk to His Holiness. And he came and said, you know, Your Holiness, I've been practicing for over 20 years now, and I'm very committed, and I do my practice, and I spend a lot of time, and it's really, you know, and he started saying, these difficult things happen with my body and my mind and my life, and you know, I can't get my meditation. And you know, I really feel like I'm struggling with this. And His Holiness looked at him, and the story I heard related was, and just imagine the sense, he looked at him very compassionately. He said, yes, yes, I hear it's really difficult, isn't it? You know, it's like that in the early years of meditation. And there's something, I think, deliciously liberating about thinking, well, if the first 20 years are the early years, hey, I can give myself permission to be where I am. It might be a little frustrating for the part of us that wants to know when I'm going to get somewhere, but in a way that part could probably, you know, enjoy a well-deserved rest for a little while. And just say, oh, maybe this is where I'm supposed to be. In fact, starting to trust that fact is one of the most liberating things we can do. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't room for learning and for transformation within where we find ourselves. But that only comes from allowing ourselves to be there. And from not assuming that somehow we shouldn't be there yet. Or still, sorry. So, patience. Beginning again. So many times we have to begin again in meditation. And yet, this moment offers us the blessing of infinite grace. We can always begin again. It's always here for us. It's never gone away when we say, let's reconnect. It's here. And so too the potential for learning and for awakening. It's always here. It never leaves us. Even if we at times forget it. So, taking it one moment, one step, one day at a time. Patience. Truthfulness. Sakya. Another beautiful qualities referred to. Truthfulness. So much suspicion, so much fear, so much confusion and pain caused by how hard we find it as human beings to simply be truthful. Simply say things how they are. And this parami is the one that is said in the story of the Buddha. I don't think I said fully. The Buddha, in the story, and whether one takes this as a metaphor or a literal description of the process, it's said that he had the opportunity to awaken long, many, 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 many lifetimes before he in fact did. But he encountered another Buddha in that life. And he realized that this Buddha had developed incredible, beautiful, all these parami, these qualities, in a way that enabled him to be the perfect teacher and servant of all beings. And he resolved, he said, actually, that's what I wish to do. And so he spent, it seems, many lifetimes cultivating and developing these qualities that I'm speaking about. And it's related that throughout all that time, he messed up a lot. He got a lot of things wrong. He didn't have them perfected, obviously, therefore he would. But that he was always truthful. And in that, what's important here is not that we actually are always truthful, because sometimes we'll get that wrong too, but that we're honest with ourselves about where we're truthful and where we're not able to be. honest with ourselves. At the bottom line, if we can't be honest with ourselves, we're really taking away or undermining the possibility of seeing what's true, which is really from the place from which transformation comes. So what is it to be honest with ourselves? Honesty with others comes from that. To be honest with ourselves. In simple terms, it's to acknowledge where we have our limitations and our places we could learn and grow. Without judging or blaming, but just saying, yeah, actually in this area I haven't developed so well. To acknowledge those places, to see how can I support that capacity. Just as if we realize that a part of our body isn't very strong or healthy, we might do some exercise for it. If we realize that actually I have a hard time sharing with others, then just practice giving things away now and then. Just small things can be done in that way. So honesty is what allows us to do that. Or we could equally be, you know, recognizing and that being honest with ourselves, actually it's really hard for me to give to myself. To let myself receive. I find this much harder. I've made a practice at one point of asking for things that I possibly needed, but didn't necessarily, just to practice, because it's so hard to sometimes just say, can I have the salt? Shouldn't be hard, should it? But probably I'm not the only one who sometimes has thought, you know, I'd rather grab in front of three people's face than have to ask for something. Or it comes out as, you know, pretty please, if you don't mind, would you mind giving me the salt? It's like, salt, please. And yet there's something going on that needs to be understood there. Being honest with oneself, it's like, oh yeah, this is hard for me. Not, this is silly, but this is hard for me. What's actually harder for most of us, though, is not recognizing the places where we have some limitation or difficulty. In fact, if I said to you all, so the next exercise, practicing honesty, we're all going to write down five things about ourselves that need a definite upgrade. We'd all be a little squirmy about it, but most of us could do it. And then I said, okay, read them out. Yeah, we'd probably be okay with that, most of us. What if I said, write down five things that are actually really wonderful about you? And read them out. Ooh. For a lot of us, that would be a lot harder. Now, for yourself, that might be different, but culturally, we're much more inclined to almost promote our deficiency. And we're really scared of honouring our beauty, because it looks like it's somehow big-headed or egotistic. But it's just as egoic to deny what is noble and beautiful and lovely within you, as it is to promote it. And sometimes I think truthfulness asks us to really honour ourselves for the many good things that are part of our lives that we've brought into being or supported in so many ways. And of course then this becomes a basis for speaking and for communicating when we're grounded in that sense of what feels true for us. So equanimity is the next parami. I want to speak of equanimity as ability to receive what comes. It's not that things are always peaceful or calm for us. Equanimity doesn't mean, you know, nothing happens. It means that when the storms blow, we have some sense of ground that we can connect with. Do we have some sense of being anchored in our life rather than just blown by the winds and the waves and the ocean currents? So the willingness to be open to our life, open to experience, to be open to the food that appears in front of us and say, this is what I have to eat. Even if it's not what I wish for or prefer. It's like, even if it makes me feel upset or angry or reactive or annoyed or bored or whatever, what's it like just to receive all experience? The way the quality is described, it's like the sun that shines on all things. It doesn't decide I'll shine on this and I won't shine on that. It just shines. It's the sense of being willingness, being open in that way. And part of the quality that I was speaking of when we were practicing, that sense of permeability, of allowing things to come in, being not rigid in the way we respond to or receive experience. It's like, oh yeah, actually, there's space for this too. There's space for this too. It's like an ocean-going boat that has a keel. And the keel, the ball that sticks down into the water, the deeper the sense of that keel goes into the water, then the wind and the waves and the currents don't blow the boat over, don't just tip it over. Still, it's impacted by them. But there's that sense of being rooted. And so there's something about what that quality of equanimity represents. It's like our rootedness into the truth of where we are. And that connection that we develop through practice into the present moment. That sense of, yes, here I can find a refuge and a sense of at-homeness. Not because of the favourability of the conditions, but because there's something about this capacity to be present and awake in the midst of it all that is ultimately unshaken by whatever happens to be blowing through, whatever happens to be moving in our life. And we start to learn and to trust that moment by moment, just in the sense, actually, yeah, I can be here in the midst of this too. Sometimes that requires that quality of resolve, of determination, of adhitana, the sense of, I will stay present. I've already made my life. And the expression of the quality in the story of the Buddha, when on the night of his awakening, he says, when he takes his seat under the Bodhi tree, and he says, I will not move from this spot until I have realized that which can be realized by human endeavor. I will not move. Though my blood run dry, though my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this spot until I have realized that which can be realized by human endeavor. And there's a quality in that. It's just this very upright, firm, strong, just whoop, adhitana. It's sort of got that, even in the word, whoop. It feels like a sword or a staff just planted. And it's like that quality of inner conviction and confidence that just says, I'll stay here. That doesn't mean that somehow we don't ever get up from our cushion. What that really represents is the orientation towards the truth and the immediacy of our life that's here and now. Saying, this, I'm not going to move from this. I want to commit to this. I want to make this the priority. And for our lives, we need this quality. Because there is so much that pulls us or pushes us in other directions. And to get clear, what is the central pole around which our life turns? What is the central or the core axis that our life moves in relationship to? And we can express or describe that in different ways, but to feel when we get in touch with that sense of what feels true, what feels of value, of meaningfulness in our lives, to say, to this, yes, I will not move from this. Something very powerful in that capacity. But it's not a rigidity or a tightness. It's just that sense of confidence and rootedness in one's commitment. From that place of resolve and sitting under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha's awakening came to full fruition. These teachings came to be shared and passed down through generations to ourselves, as the living generation who share and partake of them. These teachings point to and speak to wisdom and to kindness, to love. And these are the two paramis left in the list. The wisdom to see how things are, panya. Wisdom has the character that when we see it and when we act on what it suggests, suffering is diminished and ultimately dissolved, released, gone. To see things as they are, to see how things move and change. Now ultimately there isn't any lasting satisfaction to be found in changing flow and experience. And that there isn't anyone to be found in that either, to whom it refers. And yet at the same time to see that in this process of being conscious, awake and connected, in the very midst of that experience, not apart from it, there is a truth and a freedom that is revealed, that can be known in the human heart, though not conceived in the human mind. And that this wisdom and freedom, this transformation that comes out of seeing, out of looking, out of being willing to not assume we already know, it's a crucial feature of wisdom, is the willingness to look again, to look fresh, and to see that when truth touches us, when it speaks to us, it has the character of always being fresh and at the same time familiar. When we have an insight, when we understand something, it's like, ah, as if for the first time, and yet almost always, and I know that, I knew that, is with it as well. So this is something we can notice, we can sense, the mark of wisdom. It's fresh and it's familiar. If it's only familiar, you have to be a little cautious. It starts to sound like ideas and concepts and memories. If it's only fresh, well, we also just want to listen and see. What is it that lets us know it's true? Because that's the place where the recognition comes in. Truth recognizes itself. Wisdom knows itself. And it speaks to us of that when we're in its presence. And from that wisdom, from that truth, the natural expression of life is one of care and of kindness, of well-wishing for others equally as for ourselves. The natural and unstoppable wish for the well-being, for the happiness, for the freedom and the peace of all beings, of all hearts, of all life. And the natural wish to contribute to that. This parami of metta, of loving kindness, of friendliness, that sense of caring for others equally as we care for ourselves. Not making distinctions in the end between those we love or feel close to and those we may feel distant from or estranged from, that we might feel angry with or delighted in. But that we understand that all life is ultimately indivisible. When we see the way things are, when we see the fluidity of life, we begin to understand that we cannot extract or separate any one part from the whole in a way that is meaningful or ultimate. And that life's fulfillment is found in responding to it all with simple willingness to care for and to see what might be offered to that welfare and well-being. The character of loving kindness is that friendliness that doesn't see something as other, but ultimately sees all around us as that which we are. And therefore that natural caring which I spoke of at the beginning, that brings us into life, that brings us into practice, is not boundaried or limited in any way by a sense of where it should or should not go, but is really freed and liberated to flow out, to touch all of life. And it's for this that Dharma teachings and Dharma practice is offered and engaged in, for the well-being and for the liberation of all. So I'd like to conclude with a version of the Bodhisattva vow which is an expression, and this is a free translation from Shantideva, of that wish and that aspiration that one's life be in service of life, which doesn't in any way involve excluding the caring for ourselves. It's important that we hear this, but that we see ourselves and what we are as something not limited in the way we've imagined it to be. Something that includes, that's inclusive, rather than exclusive. And so, if you'd like to just sit quietly and listen, and then we'll just sit quietly together a few moments. We can have the sense of ourselves as gardeners. We're not always in charge of the garden in terms of what grows there, but we can start to recognize those things growing that don't seem to really serve and learn what it means to do a bit of weeding now and then. And we can also begin to recognize those wholesome and good qualities that bring nourishment or joy, the vegetables and the flowers that grow. And the joy is equally as important as the nourishment there and what we bring forth in our hearts. That this comes not from forcing it to happen, just as we can't force a seed to sprout or grow, but by the working of the soil, the softening of the earth, the providing warmth and moisture where needed. And this is very much the qualities we bring in our attention, our care, so that life can grow, can flower, and that the fruit and the flowers of that work is something for the benefit of life. So here Shantideva says, and we may sense maybe for ourselves what this might mean. May I be a guard for those who are without protection, a guide for those who journey on the road. For those who wish to go across the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an island for those who yearn for landfall, and a lamp for those who long for light. For those who need a resting place, a bed, and for all who need a helper, may I be a servant. May I be a wish-fulfilling jewel, the vase of plenty, a word of power and the supreme remedy. May I be the trees of miracles and for every being the abundant cow. Like the great earth and the other elements, enduring as the sky itself endures, for the boundless multitude of living beings, may I be the ground and vessel of their life. Thus for every single thing that lives, vast in number like the boundless reaches of the sky, may I be their sustenance and nourishment until they pass beyond the bounds of suffering. And so too, and so long as any living beings endure,